right?
Wamraga Moses, Yinan Walla, Walla Yukuma Yego, Narabura Fera Yumanaya.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
And this is Uncle Dennis and Auntie Maureen Atkinson singing Bura Fera. This song was brought to Aboriginal people in Kamaraganja by the Fisk Jubilee Singers, an African-American gospel choir who were touring out here a little while ago, back in the 1800s. It's based on the well-known Bible story of Moses and the children of Israel fleeing Egypt and crossing the Red Sea. And it made such an impression on the Aboriginal people who heard it that they asked if they could translate it into their own language. The Fisk Jubilee Singers, of course, said yes.
You see, a word there called Yumana simply means people. Bura Fera is big boss Pharaoh. So you can get the connection there. Pharaoh was chasing the people and they crossed the Red Sea. I learned this when I was a boy. I'm 73, 72 or something like that.
Right.
Now, so that's a long time ago.
We'll hear plenty more from Uncle Dennis and Auntie Maureen as we take a look at reconciliation and what this means for Aboriginal people living in Australia.
Every year, National Reconciliation Week celebrates and aims to build on the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians. It kicks off on the 27th of May, the anniversary of the 1967 referendum. This is when 90% of Australians, an overwhelming majority, voted to allow the Commonwealth to create laws for Aboriginal people and to include Aboriginal people in the census. If we go back to the wording of the Constitution before the referendum, it's quite surreal. For example, Section 127 says, "In reckoning the numbers of the people of the Commonwealth, Aboriginal natives shall not be counted." It's only very recently that Aboriginal people even began to be officially counted as people in this country.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's been 50 years since the 1967 referendum. And at the time, Joe McGuinness, an Aboriginal leader and president of the Federal Council for the Advancement of Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders, said this. He said, "Winning the referendum is an important step forwards, but it's only the first step." Wasn't that the truth? It seems pretty fitting that the theme for National Reconciliation Week this year is Let's Take the Next Steps, because while there have been important and long overdue moves towards reconciliation, there are still many more steps that need to be taken.
So for this episode, we sent our producer, Karen Tong, to Kamaraganja. It's a pretty significant place when it comes to Aboriginal rights and to Christianity. It's where some of the key Aboriginal leaders of the 1967 referendum, like Sir Doug Nicholls and Auntie Marge Tucker, grew up, discovered the Christian faith, and formed their thinking about justice and reconciliation. Though, as we'll hear in a moment, reconciliation may not be quite the right word.
There's a single dirt road into Kamaraganja and no house numbers. So I've parked on the side of the road to try and figure out where Uncle Dennis and Auntie Maureen live. I've tried to call them a couple of times, but they're not answering the phone. A woman comes out of a house, close to where my car's parked, and asks me what I'm doing. So I tell her who I'm looking for. Uncle Dennis, she points towards a house across the road. He's just over there, with the caravan out the front.
Hello, are you Auntie Maureen?
Yes, I am.
Hi, I'm Karen.
Karen.
Are you expecting me? I'm here to do an interview with both of you and Pastor Dennis.
Dennis, do you know the 15th today?
It turns out I've arrived a day earlier than they expected, but that doesn't faze Uncle Dennis and Auntie Maureen. They welcome me into their home.
Well, I'm classed as an elder in this area, so as an elder I welcome you to this country.
Within minutes of meeting Uncle Dennis, he's telling me all about Kamaraganja, how his grandfather was born here and lived here his whole life, how his father was born here and went to school here, but he left and never wanted to come back. There's nostalgia in his voice, but also pain. Cummeragunga was one of the Aboriginal reserves set up by the Australian government in 1881. Most of the original residents moved there from Maloga Mission, a few miles away, where the missionary Daniel Matthews and his wife Janet had established a place of refuge for local Aboriginal people. But the reserve wasn't quite the same. One of the worst things about Cummeragunga, and this was true back in Dennis's dad's time, was the manager.
Like my father, he used to tell me about his early days. And as a young man, or everyone on Cummeragunga, had to have a letter from the manager to be able to go out the gate. If they wanted to go and work somewhere or go and visit someone else in another town, they had to have a letter from the manager.
Yeah.
And then when they came back, they had to report to the manager, that sort of thing.
Dennis also tells me that there was this manager who used to carry a gun. He wouldn't let anyone else carry one though, but that was probably a good thing. They would have done away with him, Uncle Dennis says, because he was a cruel man. But, as I'm about to find out, there is light and shade in the history of this place.
My name is Dennis Atkinson. I am Christian. As a matter of fact, I'm a retired pastor. I was a pastor for about 35 years. Yeah, now living on Cummeragunga, which is my ancestral home. Yeah, retired here and enjoying life. And God has been good to me all those years.
When Cummeragunga was established, a lot of the Aboriginal people who moved there were already Christians, including Uncle Dennis's great-grandfather.
And Cummeragunga became like a big Christian centre. Everyone went to church, and they even now talk about the Cummeragunga Choir, which was like over 100 people singing. And they used to travel around singing. My great-grandfather was actually a preacher, Edgar Atkinson. He was an evangelist preacher. Plus, his brothers were also preachers. So, you know, Christianity was a big thing on Cummeragunga. It was a Christian place. Despite the bad things, like the manager and that, there was a lot of good stuff. When my wife and I had done our Bible college training, we decided to come to Cummeragunga and have church. By this time, things had died down. There was no church on Cummera. So we started up church, and it was like lighting a fire. Just about everyone came to church. The hall wasn't big enough to keep everyone, put everyone in there. I played guitar, and they would sing so loud and so lovely that I couldn't hear my guitar playing. It was, really good memories like that.
It was also the place where many successful Aboriginal leaders and activists grew up, including Sir Douglas Nicholls, the first Aboriginal person to be knighted, or, as he was better known, Pastor Doug.
By the way, he didn't like being called Sir Doug Nicholls.
Pastor.
Yeah, he wanted to be known as Pastor Doug. And we called him Uncle Doug. He had a lot of influence on me because I saw him as not just a pastor, but he was an Aboriginal pastor. So, yeah, that was something that I wanted as well as a young person. He never preached with notes. He would prepare a message and use his Bible, but he would never look at notes. He'd remember them beforehand. I never could do that. I tried, but couldn't quite make it.
Pastor Doug's Christian faith played a crucial role in his fight for justice for Aboriginal people. He loved his people.
And that's the sort of person he was. If it had to do with his people, he was there, you know. Things like Lake Tyers Mission, the government wanted to close it down because it's a very beautiful place and it would have been good for, you know, to set up some sort of resort or whatever there. They wanted to close it down. And the people said, no way, and they marched. Well, Sir Doug was there marching with them. So, yeah, that sort of thing. He was interested in what was good for the people.
Pastor Doug was one of the leaders of the 1967 referendum, a successful campaign to amend two rather bewildering clauses in the Constitution, changes that would finally allow for the recognition of Aboriginal people. They won by a landslide. 90% of Australians voted yes for changes that would allow the Commonwealth government to make laws to help Aboriginal people and for Aboriginal people to be counted in the national census. Campaigns like the referendum, Pastor Dennis says, signalled a shift in the way Aboriginal people fought for justice. In the past, we're talking the earlier years of Australia's colonisation, many Aboriginal people resisted the early settlers and a lot of people died.
But then there came a time in my father's time and Uncle Doug's time, when they were young, where there was a turn, there was a different mindset, in that if we don't try and get along with these people, we're finished, we're going to die out. So there was a change, and so instead of fighting against the system, they said, let's join it, let's work, let's get jobs, let's do the best we can in the white man's world. We're never going to have our nation back. Let's try and get the best we can for our Aboriginal people so at least we survive. And I'm pleased that happened. Otherwise, we wouldn't have survived. Aboriginal people would have died out in the reserves. So for a lot of Aboriginal people, the referendum wasn't such a big thing. But for many, it was. It helped with the way that Aboriginal people were accepted by non-Aboriginal people. That's what it did. It sort of broke down some barriers there.
Maybe this is how Pastor Doug felt about the referendum as well. He knew that it would be a significant but largely symbolic win. In an interview with an ABC reporter in the lead-up to the referendum, he was asked, in real terms, what would a yes vote mean? That's the magic question, he answered. Regardless, he never gave up the fight. It was only in his final years, after his wife passed away, that Pastor Doug retired.
So can you tell me a bit about that time that you spent with him?
What happened was he'd lost his wife. And that's a story in itself, because they used to have a prayer time every morning together. And this morning they'd have breakfast, then they'd have prayer time. And she prayed, he prayed, and when he opened his eyes, she was still sitting there, but she'd gone. But he never recovered from that.
Pastor Doug was moved to a nursing home in Maroopna and lived out the rest of his days there.
He had some memory, and why I say that is, the family called me when he died, or they thought he died. They said, Dad is gone. We've been with him for the last hour. They said, would you come and pray with us? So I went to the nursing home, and he was lying there, you know, like in a coma. So I grabbed his hand, and I said, now, Uncle Doug, I'm going to read your favourite verse, which was, I've finished, right?
I've fought
a good fight. I've finished the race. Huh. There's a crown laid up, you know, that verse in Timothy. And so I read that. Well, I said before I read it, I said, now, if you hear me and understand, I want you to grab my hand, squeeze my hand. And he did. So it meant that he heard me and he understood.
The work of Pastor Doug and so many of his contemporaries is often seen as reconciliation, the celebrating and rebuilding of relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people living in Australia. But that's not exactly how Uncle Dennis sees it. He tells me that his views may be a bit too strong, or so he's been told. He's gotten into trouble for saying what he's about to say.
Yeah, reconciliation is the wrong word. We need conciliation before we can have reconciliation. So, yeah.
What would conciliation look like then for you?
Conciliation now would be a discussion made from the British colony and the Aboriginal leaders of the country saying, how can we fit together now? How can we run this country? That's conciliation. Talk about how. You know, what's happened in the past, what's our future. Conciliation, that's talking. Reconciliation is returning to something that was before. And in the last 230-odd years, there's no time that we can return to, because Aboriginal people have only seen disaster. They've only seen a million of their people killed in terrible circumstances. So there's no time to return back to. It's a silly word. When the British came, that's when conciliation should have happened. Okay, we've come from England. We want to live in your country. How can we do that? What are the ground rules for us living here? This country would have been so much better. I mean, it's a beautiful country as it is, but it could have been a lot better as far as Aboriginal people are concerned, if the conciliation happened then.
His wife, Annie Maureen, feels the same way. She doesn't think there can be reconciliation because there's no good time to go back to.
No, because of what I went through, I don't see it. I'm of the stolen generation. When I was 8 years old, we were taken away from our parents. There was eight of us in the family. Two boys, the two eldest boys, went together to a home in Adelaide. The three youngest boys went to another home, boys' home, in Adelaide. And my two sisters were taken to a foster home in Adelaide together. So they were all together, and I was left at Umiwara Mission in Port Augusta, South Australia.
Annie Maureen points to a painting behind her. It's covered in bubble wrap. She says it tells a story. So we take off the bubble wrap, and it's this beautiful canvas of earthy colours with dark circles scattered across it. They're connected, though, by a trail of white dots. I ask her to explain it to me, and she says it's called loss and separation.
When I started talking my language, the other kids said, who do you think you are? You're white. You're not black. And that's not, you know, it was changing my identity, changing who I was. And because I'd lost so much, I'd lost my siblings, I lost my language, I lost my culture. And so, yeah, it was very, very hard.
Annie Maureen points to a grey figure in the top right quarter of the painting.
This is me at Umiwara. I found it hard because I wasn't black, I wasn't white. So I must have been some dirty grey colour in between. And that's how I saw myself, which was sad. When my brothers and sisters were taken away, down the bottom there, that's the two eldest boys together, the three youngest boys together, and my sisters together at a foster home. They wanted the foster mother to take me as well. And she said, oh no, I can't take her. I just want the two pretty young ones. How did that make me feel? And because we were in the mission, we weren't allowed to be inside at all. We had to play outside all day. But there were times when I needed to get away. And there was one little dark spot, a little room.
She's pointing at a little black circle next to the grey figure.
And we weren't allowed inside, but I'd go there. And that's my time to mourn my family. I'd just sit there and rock backwards and forwards, just missing them so much. And yeah, it was hard being there, but it became easier for me because I had the Lord Jesus, and he was always there for me.
When I ask Uncle Dennis if there's been any sort of conciliation, any at all, he says no. But then, after a long pause, he says,
"One good thing that has happened in this country as far as Aboriginal concern, as far as I'm concerned, is that the British bought the gospel. We wouldn't have known about salvation if it wasn't for those British missionaries who came. And I'm not talking about all the British people who came, but there was one or two in there that came who had a heart for the people, and they brought the gospel. I'm so pleased they did. Because I now have eternal life. Wouldn't have had that before. So it's worth it all. This country's only, well, I shouldn't say only, it's a beautiful country. And used to be controlled by Aboriginal people, but it's only temporary. Heaven is eternal. That's what's more important.
Oh, hello. This used to be our kindergarten, but it's now been used by the Land Council office. But it's a pity, because like 20 years ago, this was really a picture. This was our old folks' home, and now look at it. They said they couldn't get government funding to keep it going. That's a pity.
I'm sitting in the back seat of Uncle Dennis's car. We're going for a drive around Cummeragunja. The old folks' home he's just mentioned, it's a hollowed-out shell of a building. No windows or doors. It's beige walls tagged with black graffiti.
This corner here is where the old church used to be. And it was left vacant so the church could be built. But the land council won't allow the church to be built.
Do you know why?
No, just there's no. They don't see that it's important.
Out of all the vacant plots of land in Cummeragunja, this one definitely hits Uncle Dennis the hardest. A little further down the road, I take a look out the window and see an overgrown field. The grass is knee-high at least.
On our right here, we used to have basketball and netball courts, football ground over there. All dilapidated, all left vacant. I'd love to see it flourishing again like it used to be. But I think the government would like to see Cummeragunja closed down.
Before we leave, I ask Uncle Dennis to take me to the Cummeragunja schoolhouse. His grandfather and father were students there, and so was Uncle Doug. It was where they formed a lot of their thinking about Aboriginal issues and justice, and it's a place that gave them confidence and dignity.
Is this the schoolhouse here?
Yes.
It's also the place where they conduct funerals.
Aboriginal people always have big funerals. When somebody dies,
yeah.
The average number of people at a funeral would be about 1,000. And Sir Doug Nichols, or Uncle Doug, his funeral, there was about 2,000 people. And this is where we had his funeral, here. I've conducted many funerals, and they've always been here on the veranda of the old school, because there's no church on Cummeragunja now. It was burnt down back in about 1940 or something like that.
We walk up the steps onto the veranda and take a seat on the bench that stretches across the front of the building. The education was probably better here in Cummeragunja than any other Aboriginal reserve in Australia, Uncle Dennis tells me. And it's all thanks to Thomas James, a highly educated Indian man from Mauritius who taught generations in this schoolhouse and was a huge part of what this place meant to those who grew up here.
He was actually a doctor, came to Australia, and he couldn't practice medicine because he didn't have a license in Australia. So he went into teaching people, and they sent him to Cummeragunga to teach. And he loved the place, and he married an Aboriginal girl here.
Uncle Dennis says that Aboriginal kids were only taught up to the third grade because the government didn't want Aboriginal people taking non-Aboriginal jobs. That's why the school in Cummeragunga was so important. Mr. James was giving these kids a chance to, eventually, earn a living and make their way in a world that was often hostile to them. Kids like Uncle Dennis's dad and his role model, Pastor Doug.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was very important for them. Gave them a bit more confidence, you know, in a white man's world. They could compete more. My dad wasn't intimidated by anything, and neither was Uncle Doug. Yeah, they felt like they were equal to anyone else.
Equality, confidence, dignity. These ideas have been central to the history of this place, at least at some points, and all too elusive over the last two centuries of white settlement.
One of the things that saddens me for the last 200 years is the way that Aboriginal dignity has been destroyed. And only a few people like Uncle Doug, William Cooper, and several others have risen above that and said, you're not going to destroy my dignity. I've still got it. You know, hopefully I can be sort of up close to them as well. I think I've still got my dignity as an Aboriginal person. And my father certainly did. He rose above it. He became a leader in the community, in a non-Aboriginal community. He was the coach of the local football team, where there was 90% non-Aboriginal people in the team and a few Aboriginal people. So he was up there, you know, he maintained his dignity. And he said to me, never forget that you're an Aboriginal, but do the best you can in a white man's world. So that's what I've tried to do, with the help of the Lord Jesus.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. For Reconciliation Week, our producer Karen Tong is bringing you stories from Cummeragunga and Shepparton on either side of the New South Wales-Victoria border.
Shepparton is the site of a mural featuring the faces of William Cooper and Sir Doug Nicholls, two giants in the history of reconciliation or conciliation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in Australia.
Hello. Hi, I'm Karen.
Hi.
You must be Uncle Boydie.
That's right.
Hi, it's nice to meet you.
Alf Turner, or Uncle Boydie as he's known to most people, is turning 90 this year. That's one of the first things he tells me. And, I notice, he's impeccably dressed. Shoes polished, pants ironed so there's that crease down the centre, a shirt and tie with a sweater pulled over the top. Later, Uncle Boydie tells me that this is something he learned from his grandfather, William Cooper. He wouldn't go out the front door unless he was dressed properly, with his hat and tie on.
If you turn around,
we're heading to Shepparton's town centre to see a mural that's been painted for Reconciliation Week. It's a portrait of his grandfather and Sir Doug Nicholls. Both men were iconic Aboriginal leaders who spent their lives fighting for Aboriginal people, for their recognition and their rights.
So when you met with the artist, what were some of the things he wanted to talk to you about?
He wanted pictures of the faces right up close, like wrinkles and all that sort of stuff. And he's put a few of his own in. But it's knowing both those men, it's a dead spit on them.
Yeah.
Very like, the likenesses are very good.
What was it like to see it the first time?
Oh, terrific.
Yeah.
Never thought that would happen.
On the drive, Uncle Boydie starts to talk about going to school in Cummeragunja, at the old schoolhouse there, just like his grandfather and Uncle Doug before him.
Well, when I went to school at Cumra, the parents told me, my mother told me, if you see a big black car coming into the Cumra, run and hide.
Wow.
And that's what the kids used to do.
Yeah.
They were taking the fair-skinned ones. So I was always, frightened I'd be taken. One day,
there was always a chance the big black car was coming for Uncle Boydie because of his fair skin. Even today, he's often mistaken for a Greek, he tells me.
One day there was a car came in and everybody ran out of school. A kid ran to the door and said, there's a car coming. And they all jumped up and ran because, as I said, you didn't know whether you'd be taken or not. I ran down to where they bring the boat across, yelling out to Mum, bring the boat, I'll jump in and swim. I couldn't swim, but I would have jumped in. I was that frightened.
I'm standing in front of the mural with Uncle Boydie. It's on the side of a building facing an alleyway that leads to a car park. And it's a magnificent sight. The background is a wash of black, red and yellow, and in the foreground, giant close-ups of William Cooper's and Pastor Doug's faces in black and white.
Can you just tell me like a little bit about what these two men mean to you?
Oh, well, both of them mean a lot to me now. I didn't realise it at the time. But they were two Christian men that fought pretty hard for their Aboriginal people. And I think that what they did in their day is coming to pass today.
What did they want to see for Aboriginal people that you think has happened today?
Well, Grandfather William Cooper always wanted to be his people to be drawn into the outside communities, and that never happened until the past few years now. It's happening today. And I think that if they were here, they would be very pleased about that. Both men fought for the same thing. When Grandfather passed on, Uncle Doug took up the fight and he fought until he passed on himself. So these two men really dedicated themselves to fighting for their people. They wanted them to be a part of the population of Australia, and in the beginning they weren't counted as a people. They were counted as flora and fauna, and that wasn't fair to any people at all. I don't know whether it happened in any other countries, but it certainly happened here. And I think that these two men would be very pleased if they could look back and or look forward to today and know what happened through the work they did in their time.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore.
And our producer, Karen Tong, with stories about reconciliation and the need to keep taking steps forward to build the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people living in Australia.
If you want to hear more stories like this one, you can find plenty on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on Apple Podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us.
You may be interested in this story from Broken Hill.
You know, I used to get drunk, used to smoke drugs, broke into a few, you know, got involved in stealing, was never caught for it. I suppose they were a rite of passage, some of those things, into adulthood. And it wasn't until a group of young people come to Dubbo from a an Aboriginal Bible college, and I had seen in them something that I didn't see in anyone else.
Next week, as large parts of the world become more religious, why is it that in the West, more and more people claim no religion? Join us then.
Hey, it's me again. Just a couple of people I want to thank because without them, this episode would not have been possible. First, Matt Andrews. He brought this story to us and put me in contact with Uncle Dennis, Auntie Maureen and Uncle Boydie. This is a voice message he left me on the morning I drove to Cummeragunja.
Hey Karen, it's Matt Andrews, just calling from Sydney. I know you're on country this morning and you're about to meet Pastor Dennis and Auntie Maureen, some of the most magnificent people in one of the most magnificent parts of the country, and you'll never forget today.
Also, my friend Valeria Saglambene. We clocked up more than 1,500 kilometres over 3 days together on the road to get to all the interviews. Here's a bit of our conversation after visiting Cummeragunja.
I know when we were driving onto Cummeragunja Drive,
yeah,
and we both, I think, felt like crying for some reason.
Yeah, I could breathe the atmosphere. I could feel it was a special place.
Yes, and it was weird because it was like we just turned onto the road, like on the road just outside, nothing.
Very true. And we were just, I don't know, 5 minutes before, we were just talking about Italy. So, and then a few minutes of silence and then the atmosphere changes suddenly, very suddenly. I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
And Uncle Boydie, who, by the way, was really excited to show us his pet, cockatoo.
He's coming in. Good boy. Good boy.
Hello.
Boy.
Yes, that's the pet cockatoo saying hello. And finally, Uncle Dennis and Auntie Maureen. They were so generous with their time, not only in speaking with us and showing us around Cummeragunja, they sang a couple of songs for us as well. And here's one of them.
When I was in the mission, we weren't allowed to speak our language, but the missionaries, I thought they were pretty smart. They taught us choruses in language. But I put one together with Pidginjarra, wasn't it?
Mm.
I heard these Māori people singing and I said, can I put Aboriginal words to that? And they said, go ahead and do it. And this is it. We're going to sing it for you. You started us now.